Well, hello everyone, this is Rillian. Welcome to the Nerdy Web Podcast, and I just wanted to welcome JimFan today. How are you doing, JimFan?
I'm doing quite well, thank you.
But seriously now, this is the first podcast we're going to be doing without Rillian, Podcasting Prince, and
We've revolted.
I feel a little strange right now, being kind of the host position, but it's kind of cool. It doesn't seem like that. Actually, it does seem like quite a while ago that Rillian first sent me the link to this podcast he was doing. It was not a Narnia Web podcast. It was like, hey, tell me what you think of this. And I think it's pretty cool that it's taking on a life beyond its creator, you know, its own legacy.
But the podcast will be going on long, long after he's gone.
maybe they'll reboot the franchise after they make all these, and then we can pass it on to the next generation of Narnia Web podcasting. But
yeah.
That's getting a little ahead of ourselves.
And it's being slightly presumptuous.
Right.
The future.
It's true. But we will get to that eventually. So when we left off our commentary on Dawn Treader, the crew had just, they left the Lone Islands, and a sequence that felt very, very short. And, anyway, I wasn't there, so. But I'm sure all my thoughts are definitely online.
Yeah.
So then the crew, they get going, and we have this one thing that I've been saying for a while that I've been saying for a couple of years I did not think would work was Eustace's journal.
Yeah, that's so great.
In the book. It allows you to get inside his head and see the sort of that distorted way he views the
life
world.
In general.
Yeah, and a lot of his humor comes from that. How did you think that worked in the movie, the way they use Eustace's journal in kind of various places throughout the voyage?
Well, I thought, as you said, I thought it was really cool that they found a way to incorporate it in there. And I thought it worked pretty well. It didn't seem jarring or, like, it took people out of the moment too much or it was too weird to have a quote-unquote narrator. But I thought it was great to get Eustace's viewpoint on things without engaging in a super long dialogue sequence or whatever. You know what I mean?
Yeah,
they were able to have his journals. Like, sometimes the things are so simple, you don't reinvent the wheel.
Yeah, I mean, I guess the main reason you were talking about narration, I guess, and that's kind of one of the things I was saying. It's not very cinematic, you know. It's so seamless in a book, you know.
Yeah.
But I think I was basically proven wrong here. This is one of the more successful things in the film. It works because they set it up when we first meet Eustace. He's writing in his journal, so it's not jarring when they jump back to it. But it helps tie together sort of the long, uneventful stretches of the voyage.
Yep.
And it also, there's some funny lines in there too. He talks about, I can only suppose this is the result of poor diet, you know, talking about some of the other characters. So you get kind of that Eustace's viewpoint, you know, which I think is really great.
Yeah, just to kind of see how his mind works, which is delightfully bad.
Yeah, he has a very distorted view of things where he always paints himself as the hero and everyone else is the nuisance.
Yeah.
But then we have that scene where he's in the middle of writing his journal and a bird lands right in front of him. And I guess he quite naturally assumes, well, it's probably a talking bird. The others didn't see it that way. The Minotaur and Rhynelf didn't see it that way. What did you think of that moment?
The humor was a little, maybe cheap, but it was interesting. You know, it was an interesting thing to see how Eustace would react to animals. I mean, I could have done without it, but it was mildly interesting in that you got to see how, you know, like, would he naturally assume that, since he's in Narnia and all these the mice talk and everyone else, he's not really had a lot of contact with animals since he's on a boat, so he sees a bird, he's like, oh, I guess this must talk too. And then some other people think that's hilariously funny. But
yeah, I thought it was really funny, and I do think it makes perfect sense that he would assume it was probably a talking bird. And I like the fact that I think this is where we kind of sympathize with Eustace a little bit here, because it's not unreal. Because obviously we're from Earth too; we've never seen talking animals, and I think I think most people would say, yeah, it's only natural he would assume that. And the fact that the others kind of make fun of him, you know, for most of the voyage, oh, Eustace is just an annoying little nuisance, but here it's like, hey, come on, guys, cut him some slack.
Give him a little break.
Yeah, and so I like that moment. It was sort of the beginning of starting to sympathize with Eustace a little bit. I did think the way that the Minotaur and Rhynelf reacted, oh, he's talking to a bird, oh, he's bad, that one, that was a little over the top and wasn't needed. But I like the idea that they would think that he's completely crazy for thinking birds can talk. You know, so that was one of my favorite humorous moments. It was an intentionally humorous moment, and it worked well. So yeah. I like that moment. So then the Eustace towards what he's asking the bird, he's like, "Oh, you know, if there's any food around here," and the bird does not respond. So he decides to go look for food himself. And he goes down to steal an orange, and this whole thing here, this whole sequence, it was one of the first things that you and I talked about after I got back from seeing the movie.
I remember well.
mainly the end of the scene we'll talk about in a second. What did you think about the fact that, you know, obviously in the book, Eustace sneaks up behind Reepicheep and swings him around by his tail, and Reepicheep is infuriated and demands they have a duel right then and there.
Well, also, this scene is sort of a mesh between that scene and also the scene later in the book where Eustace is attempting to steal water. But the way it was done in the movie, I thought it was done very well. Like, the interaction, the way they set up the relationship between Eustace and Reepicheep, and the way it sort of develops later in the movie, I thought it was really good. And I like how Reepicheep, he's not overly harsh on Eustace. Where, you know, in the book, he's more, you know, I demand satisfaction, and he treats Eustace just like everyone else. And here in the movie, he's, you know, he catches him doing it, obviously tells him not to do it, and then he's gonna let him go, and then Eustace doesn't seem to really, he's just not having it. So then Reepicheep challenges to a duel, and then he turns it into a teaching moment, you know, where he's not just, like, humiliating him or making fun of him. He's actually helping him a bit.
Well, I think where we kind of differ is you were talking about how you really liked how Reepicheep didn't come across as very harsh, and that it became a teaching moment at the end. And really, as far as the tail moment in particular, is something that Reepicheep is just offended by in the book. I think deeply offended by, and it's kind of unwritten cultural rules like that to me give the culture some depth. Things like, you know, how you do not ride a centaur. You just don't do that, you know? And whenever they do ride centaurs, they have to explain, oh, this is a big exception, you know? It's unwritten rules that make it seem real, you know? And Reepicheep, I think, was genuinely not just angry, but offended. How dare this, you know, this kid, you know, not only touch my tail, but swing me around by my tail. I mean, this is just ridiculous. And a tail is just something that Reepicheep takes very, very seriously. It's, you know, the honor and glory of a mouse. And in the movie, it seemed more like it was just kind of a joke. Oh, no one touches the tail. I did like that line they added where it's like, oh, the great Aslan himself gave me this tail. But it seemed to me like more like Reepicheep, rather than just being genuinely offended, was just kind of joking around. Like, no one touches the tail, period, exclamation mark. And even during the duel, it seems more like he's joking around rather than really being serious. And though it seemed to me it kind of cheapened up Reepicheep's character a little bit there, but you obviously don't agree?
Well, in his defense, Eustace did not actually pick him up and swing him around. Had he done that, I think we all would have expected a little more of a reaction. Whereas I think in the book, if Eustace had just touched him by the tail or grabbed him and then let him go, I don't think he would have reacted quite as strongly. Does that make sense? The reactions should not be the same for both instances.
That's a very fair point, actually. Certainly, Eustace's crimes were not as severe in the movie as what they did in the book, so I guess it makes sense that Reepicheep would be not go as crazy, but...
Because if he reacted the same way to Eustace just grabbing him by the tail, and he gives the same reaction as it does in the book, I think people would think that he is being completely unreasonable.
Overdoing it, yeah.
He's overdoing it. He's being way too touchy.
Yeah, I'll agree with you there. It makes sense to not have Reepicheep go absolutely berserk as he does in the book, but I still think I would have liked to have felt like that this is something very serious for him, that he really is offended.
Right.
And I felt like it was more like he was just kind of goofing off.
Yeah, perhaps a change of like what he said. Like, maybe he just said it differently instead of saying, oh, look, this is a great way to throw in a punchline.
Yeah.
If they had changed that, it probably would have made the effect a bit different.
Yeah. That's the beginning of the fight. Then, you know, Eustace is running away, and Reepicheep, he's, you know, trying to run away, run a boat, you know. And then there's a lot of slapstick going on here, I think, where, you know, almost cartoon physics a bit, like when Pikachu throws the orange and Drinian catches it, and it just seemed a little bit. Do you see what I'm getting at when I kind of say cartoon physics? It just seemed like
it's a little more light-handed and not like, oh, okay, this is going to be a serious duel where it's like they're just kind of
right.
messing around.
And again, I like the fact that in the book that duels are something that they take seriously. You know, again, another part. We're learning more about Narnia's culture. That no one, when Rippity calls for a duel, and Eustace is stunned to find out that no one thinks it's funny, you know. And it just seemed like in the book, it's a real way you settle conflicts. Whereas in the movie, it was more, it's sort of we're all bored and here's some entertainment. Almost like we're watching a wrestling match or something, and we're sort of cheering him on. It seemed that, I guess it didn't quite have the depth of the book. But I mean, obviously you liked the scene. So how did you feel about it?
Again, he hasn't been seriously mistreated, Reepicheep. He's not as upset, he's not as whatever. He's not treating this the same way he treated the duel in the book. So I don't mind that it's taken a bit more lightly because he's not really being, Reepicheep is not being serious about it. I don't think, you know what I mean?
That makes sense. I mean, I would say Eustace was caught stealing food, and Reepicheep rightly says it's a very serious offense. And, so I think they could have justified Reepicheep being genuinely angry about that, especially if they had incorporated the whole idea that we're short on food or water into the story, which they,
right.
which they never really did. Like they kind of did later. I did have an issue with Reepicheep saying "Yoo-hoo, over here." It's just there are several things in this movie where I'm like, did that seriously just come out of Reepicheep's mouth? And another example of where I feel like Reepicheep is pure comic relief in the movie. I don't really feel like they got emotional depth of the book.
As opposed to Prince Caspian Reepicheep?
Exactly, yeah. Prince Caspian Reepicheep, there's not much.
It's totally serious, and he never does any dumb
things. Well, I'm saying, in the book, there's not really that much to Reepicheep. He just, and we've talked about this before, he basically is not. He has about as much depth as the Bulgy Bear, you know? Oh, a bear that sucks his paws, that's kind of funny. Oh, a mouse that is really brave and fights, that's kind of funny. That's basically all Reepicheep is in the book. So I think Prince Caspian Reepicheep is pretty faithful to book Reepicheep. Don Treader Reepicheep, on the other hand, I don't think is faithful to who Reepicheep matures into and evolves into as a character. I think that they forgot, they kept Reepicheep where he was in Prince Caspian and forgot to have him mature and grow.
I don't know. I think the interaction between him and Eustace, especially later on, I think it shows more of a, I don't know, but it's kind of hard to explain, but I really have no complaints with Reepicheep in the movie, in Don Treader, whereas, as I've said, I really didn't like Prince Caspian, so I much preferred Reepicheep in Don Treader.
Interesting. I guess that's something we can talk about in a future podcast. I think that's interesting. We have that moment, there's the moment that I didn't really catch the first time you pointed out to me, where Reepicheep makes it a teaching moment. You were just talking about that.
Yes, I remember this very well because you were yelling at me because I said I liked.
Was not
me.
Yelling at you.
Yes, you were.
Okay, I was getting passionate, but I was certainly not. Don't make it sound like I was angry or anything.
You were being You were talking about something you didn't know.
Okay, yeah, which is
because you missed it. You missed the whole point.
Yeah, well, now that we've seen that it was a teaching moment, it almost, now that I've thought about it, is like I would have liked to have Reepicheep be a little more harsh and take it more seriously. And so I think this robs Reepicheep of some of his depth. But I like what they're starting here is this whole thing of Eustace, where Eustace is kind of warming up to Narnia, well, not Narnia, but that their whole world. Slowly, and he maybe even kind of privately starting to kind of like it a little bit, but then he won't let himself. So there's there's that moment where, you know, like we'll have a scene in Corey Eckhine's map room later we'll talk about where he remarks that the map looks beautiful, and he's like, I mean, for a make-believe world, you know? So here we have this whole Reepicheep is, he kind of smiles a little bit, then he's like, you know, stops, I can't remember what he says, but he's sort of wanting to embrace this world a little bit, but then he won't let him, the logical thinker.
At the end, he says, you know, we'll make a swordsman out of you yet, and Eustace is like, oh,
yeah,
he takes the compliment. He's like, "Oh, wait a second."
Yeah, that's right. I'm supposed to hate you.
I liked how they set it up with Eustace in Reepicheep. How Reepicheep is really kind of the only character who really takes any notice of Eustace at all. Everyone else kind of ignores him, and Reepicheep just spending a moment with him, and then especially later on when Eustace is a dragon, when he just jumps to his side and he becomes his his first line of defense.
Yeah, which is different from the book. You know, in the book, they're really at each other's throats, and Reaper Chief is just enraged at this boy who doesn't understand, you know, the honor of a mouse's tail and all these rules, and then really ends up having compassion on him. And in the book, he kind of has compassion on him kind of from the beginning. I'm sorry, in the movie, he does.
Yeah, I think in the movie, Reaper Chief, he's more understanding of Eustace's situation, mm-hmm. and so he is more patient with him. And again, in the movie, Eustace does not completely do something really
totally
awful
outrageous,
to him and
yeah.
swing him around. So, you know, had he done that, maybe we would have seen a different side to Reaper Chief and how he treated him, but since he doesn't, I think his demeanor is quite fitting, and I liked it.
Yeah,
so.
I mean, I don't necessarily dislike the scene. I think it's okay. It just doesn't really live up to what I was wanting. You kind of liked it. They took kind of a lighter approach to it, and I didn't. I think that's kind of where we differ there. Okay, so then after this I can't remember exactly how, but all of this leads to the MLG Gale being discovered.
Eustace, he falls back into the basket.
Knocks over some
that
stuff.
That she's hiding in.
Yeah.
Yeah.
What did you think of the way that I guess what I'm asking about is the plausibility that she could somehow sneak onto the ship and has been hiding there for, I don't know, several hours, I suppose. I'm not really sure how long it's been.
Yeah, it would have to be a couple hours. They make it seem like it's been quite a lot longer than that because we have the whole passage of time with Eustace and his journal. It doesn't really make sense, but there's a lot of stuff in this movie that doesn't really make sense.
This is true, and we're going to get into more of that.
yes,
as in future podcasts, things that don't seem to line up. I mean, I don't really buy even Caspian letting Rince on the ship, personally. I mean, there's probably a lot of people who would love to come along and save their family members. It just seems strange that... I mean, what good does Rince ultimately do? He doesn't really do anything.
Having the whole Rince, Gale, Eileen thing, it's an idea, and it's one that could have worked, but with a lot of other things in this movie, it just seemed to be executed so sloppily. Mm-hmm. They didn't really take the time to explore the back end of it and was like, okay, let's think this through for a moment.
Yeah.
And they're like, oh, that sounds good. Let's film it tomorrow.
Yeah, I mean, like, it's...
And that's what they did.
The idea of it, I think, is, you know, they have this whole green mist thing introduced, and they were trying to give us characters...
Justify it?
Well, I think it's more about... I think the writers are saying to themselves, well, we don't really know any of these people who are being swallowed up by the mist or whatever the mist is doing to them. I don't really know. But it's like, so let's give two characters on the ship who have some kind of emotional investment in this, you know?
And bringing in new characters.
And it's a little girl and, you know, they're her father. Oh, how cute. How sweet. You know, if you have a soul, how can you not react to that? It's just kind of the easy, simple way to go.
This is going to sound blasphemous, but I would have preferred... If we had to have someone to be taken, I think the way it was in the leaked script would have been a lot more emotionally invested.
Yeah, you mentioned that before.
It was Trumpkin's wife. We already have... Trumpkin has been a proven character that we like, and he would have been... If he had been in the movie, he would have been good in the movie.
Interesting. I have not given that much thought, so I don't want to respond right now, but maybe that would have been better. I mean, it's not that this is necessarily bad, it's just the way that it was just kind of... lazy and sloppy,
I have said this from the beginning, and I will say it again. A lot of the problems with the Don Treader movie has to do with the fact that they took as many references to the Silver Chair out as possible, but they kept the whole plot line in, and it just did not work without her.
You mean to the Lady of the Green Kirtle?
Yes, the Lady of the Green Kirtle.
Yeah.
Had they kept that in there, I mean, they're both not... good options.
Pick your poison.
But the leak script, it had care. It was the way it was written for that, and it all made sense. Here, it doesn't really make sense. It just was like lazy filmmaking to me. That's
it's kind
it
of thrown in
like.
There, not really developed, you know.
Yeah.
And the movie's
really
only
developed.
Like an hour and 50 minutes. It seems like they could have done more.
A lot of problems would be solved. Would have been solved if they either stuck to the leaked script, or once they got rid of the Green Witch, if they had scrapped it all and started over. I think we would ultimately have been much more satisfied with the resulting product.
Or more like, we would have been less dissatisfied, I think.
I think sometimes we as fans can come to accept changes if they're... I think it was maybe Rillian who said this. We can come to accept changes and deviations and not really like them, but at least respect them. If they're handled with great care, with a lot of thought, you know that the people care about what they're doing, even if it's not to the book. They're at least putting a lot of thought and effort into this.
Yeah, if it at least works fairly well as a movie, if it's at least well done, then yeah, it's a lot easier to swallow.
And, you know, we may not like it because it's different from the book, but at least it's handled well. Whereas
yeah.
I never really got the feeling in Don Treader that all these deviations were being handled with a lot of love and care.
So, very quickly, they don't really take time to set up suspense about the next island, just cut, and we're at the next island. They're looking at the next island, which is the Duffelpot Island, we're going to find out. I think it's the Island of the Voices, I've always called it, because that's the name of the chapter. Caspian, I think, makes another silly decision here that I cannot understand.
Rookie mistake.
He decides, they get there and it's almost dark, and Caspian decides to row ashore and sleep on the shore. This is an unknown place. Why not just spend the night on the ship? It just seems strange to me that in the book, I believe it's Dragon Island, that even though the crew is, almost dying of thirst, they get to the island almost nighttime, and Caspian doesn't want to go ashore because he's afraid of wild beasts. So they spend the night on the ship and go ashore in the morning. Because
yep.
Caspian is a more rational, logical, has some common sense in the book. And here, I cannot foresee any potential positives at all of sleeping on the shore. Why not sleep on the ship and then the next morning go ashore? It's an unknown place. It seems like it'd be more comfortable and safer.
It's kind of strange because in the last podcast, I was talking about Caspian and his decision to be really careful going into the Lone Islands. And I chalk that up to, he's a more experienced person in the movie as opposed to in the book because he's been through the whole Prince Caspian thing.
Yeah.
And he's war-wise,
it's 3 years later, yeah.
And he's being smart, and it makes sense. And then it comes to this scene, it's like, oh, throw that out the window.
Yeah. I mean, it's kind of contrived because they have to make the Duffelpuds, they have to enable them to kidnap Lucy. So it feels very contrived, like the characters make dumb decisions just because in order to move the plot forward. And then as if it wasn't, sort of silly enough, them sleeping on the shore, then Caspian apparently does not post a watch. And you might say, well, the Duffelpuds were invisible, they would not have seen them. But if there was a watch, then they weren't able to see Lucy floating up into the middle of the air and floating away. So I think even if the Duffelpuds had been visible, I still think they would have been able to walk right in among them and steal Queen Lucy from right under their noses.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's a little strange.
Yeah, and it goes by so fast. It's one of the things where they developed a little more and the pacing was a little more comfortable. Maybe I could kind of accept it. But it's like, oh, we're going to sleep on the shore. Then we no sooner has Caspian said that, but we cut to footprints in the sand.
It's something that would have improved if they'd had five more minutes to sit and kind of amp up the suspense or
easier to accept.
Seem a little more plausible or whatever.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But then Lucy is kidnapped, and I didn't think the effects, I could kind of see the lines in the effects, but it was kind of, I mean, if you haven't read the book, you're kind of watching Lucy floating away and, being smacked with branches and stuff.
You're
like, what the heck? And she's kind of bouncing along and everything.
Yeah.
But what did you think of the Duffelpud voices and being able to see their breath and all of that?
Oh, that was pretty cool. The elaborate dialogue, I guess. It kind of made sense when you find out later that they're really trying very hard to be quite threatening, so it makes sense that they'd be a bit over the top.
They have their kind of attitudes from the book of always agreeing with the chief,
Yeah, I like that was in there. I wish they had had more of them.
Yeah, it's just kind of, again, it's kind of a little Easter egg for fans, but it's not really a big part. You don't have enough time to get to know them for that to really stick out in your mind.
Because they're pretty cool characters.
I mean,
let's have some more Duffelpuds.
Yeah, but they're not cool yet. The moment we think they're savage beasts with claws
that's
and
right.
stuff. But Lucy is, I love the part where, they're like, you enter the house of the oppressor or else we're going to kill you. And they all start saying, death, death, death. And Lucy's like, well, if you kill me, it wouldn't be much good to you.
Then there's
a silence. Oh, hadn't thought of that. Well, then we'll kill your friends, which is, I like, because I was always worried when I learned that Lucy was going to be kidnapped, that, well, then it kind of takes away from her honor that she makes the decision to do in order to save her friends. The Reaper calls it a noble and heroic act. But I guess they have preserved that here by saying she's only doing it because She's afraid they might do something to Caspian and Edmund and all of them. How about the mansion being invisible and the way that's revealed and all of that there? What did you think about the mansion being invisible?
I guess you could say the spell put everything.
Yeah, I mean, I guess if the point is to, if invisibility is going to protect them from the mist, I guess it makes sense to make everything invisible.
Right.
So it's consistent, you know.
Yeah.
And it's pretty cool when Lucy, she's like looking around the door like, what the heck? It leads to nowhere, you know? That was kind of a cool shot. And so then she walks into probably my favorite set in the movie, which is Koryakin's library.
This is pretty cool. Pretty much how I always imagined a library.
Yeah, and that was kind of a nice... I don't feel like they're rushing through this scene. They actually take a few moments to build. It would have been nice to have, like in the book, where they spend a lot of time building up suspense. The magician might be there. He might be dead, you know? Who knows? Might be invisible. They don't really take a lot of time to set that up in the movie.
Yeah.
But nonetheless, this is fairly suspenseful.
They go straight to the Book of Spells.
The Book of Incantations.
Which I thought was really cool. I love the way the book looks. It's probably one of my favorite props from Dawn Treader, actually.
Yeah, it felt like almost a character, just kind of like in the book. And I guess C.S. Lewis's descriptions, there's no way you would ever be able to do a lot of those justice.
Yeah.
But they took a pretty good shot at it, and I love when she blows on the letters, which look a lot much. The effect looks a lot better than it did in the trailer. She blows on the letters, and they all go into place. That was really cool. And then we've got the scene that was in all the trailers, the snow, which I guess Lucy just kind of said as a test or just because she was curious. What'd you think about having the snow in there?
It didn't really make any difference either way. I thought it was really cool to get a throwback to Lion, Witch, and Wardrobe, which I'm sure that's what they were going after.
Yeah.
But it was a nice little moment of wonder in a very fast-paced movie where they actually stop for a minute. It's like, oh, look, this is cool. And everyone gets to go, ooh, and ah, and then back to business. Which I thought was cool.
I think one of the main reasons behind it was they wanted to just establish that when Lucy says these spells, they actually do work. You know, it just like to actually show one work. So now we can look at all these other spells and go, yes, it's established. She can actually make this happen just by saying the words. And I think it gives us a sense of possibility. Like, what else is in this book? You know, I guess it did. If there was any suspense in this scene, I guess that kind of killed it. Because now we're like, ooh, snow, hooray! But but nonetheless, I like how it kind of sets up the logic behind the book. We get to the beauty spell, and the mist oozes out of the pages. And this is something that's going to come up over and over throughout the movie, is the mist appearing anytime a character is tempted.
Which is a bit heavy-handed, but...
Yeah, heavy-handed's the right term for it, I think. And it's like, I don't know. Can you imagine, like, what if they had done that in Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, and every single time... I'm sorry, let's say Prince Caspian, and every single time Peter was being arrogant, oh, mist would come out, so we know he's being arrogant, you know? It's just like, it comes through perhaps a little too well.
It comes through naturally.
Perhaps a little too well. yeah, so you didn't like having to throw the mist in there whenever a character was tempted?
Yeah, I could have done without it. It didn't really...
It kind of make the characters look a little dumb, too, because the mist is always just out of their sight, you know, just behind their back. It's like, look, it's right there, you know.
Yeah, and so for I'm sure for a lot of book fans, when they're going to the movie, and it gets to part in the movie where it's like, oh, it's almost like the book, and we're just being caught up, and then the screen mist shows up, and it's like, oh, yeah.
The
we
mist.
Have this in here.
So if some fan can just, like, digitally paint out the smoke. Okay, now we're good. Now the scene's fine. Then we get to... Kind of read the beauty spell, and they have the whole Susan thing where she looks in the, like a mirror in the book, which is kind of neat.
Yeah.
It's, you know, different. And in the book, you know, she looks into the book and she sees a more.
She overhears a conversation.
Yeah, there's all that
that's
stuff
a different
they cut
one.
Out. Yeah, but she looks into the book and she sees a more beautiful version of herself, you know? And what did you think about the choice to, instead of showing a more beautiful Lucy, to show Susan?
Well, I think. That makes more sense when you're thinking about the viewers, because beauty is always in the eye of the beholder. So if we're trying to bring across the point that we're seeing someone that that Lucy thinks is more beautiful than herself, you know, a more pretty version of Lucy, and the audience may go, oh, well, the Lucy we like just fine. But it doesn't matter. What matters is what Lucy thinks, you know what I mean?
Right, exactly. You know, so now it doesn't matter if the audience doesn't find, you know, Susan more beautiful. The point is that we know that Lucy does.
Yes.
And if they made a more beautiful Lucy, then some people might go, well, she's not more beautiful. I like the real Lucy better. So that was
it's not the point, you know.
Right.
The point is how Lucy feels about herself.
Yeah, so that was, in terms of adaptation, I thought that was a good decision. Then we've got Aslan goes like, Lucy! You know, his voice comes out. And she, it apparently doesn't work, though, because she rips the page out. I was kind of startled by that. I think I'd heard about that, but was still kind of startled to see her ripping the page out. I always felt like...
Naughty.
Yeah, exactly. But then she comes across the invisibility spell and makes the duffel bud, oh, like the P in psychology and all that stuff, which really annoyed some fans for some reason. I was kind of like, you know, whatever about it.
I don't really care either way.
Yeah, I guess I love how in the book, you know, Lewis says, you know, Lucy recited the words, nothing would possess me to tell you what they were. And I always thought that was really funny. I like that idea, that Lewis knew them, but wasn't going to share everything. But then the Dufflepuds are made visible, and it reveals that they're not as big and ferocious as we were led to believe. And particularly, they're certainly not as tall. What do you think about how the way the Dufflepuds were, when they become visible again, they're like, oh yeah, we're ferocious, and then we see that they're just standing on each other.
I loved it. That's humor that I can get behind. It's funny. I loved it.
It's one of those things where it's like, I almost wish, this is the only time you'll ever hear me say this about this movie, I almost wish Lewis had done that, or something like that, because that's so in character for them, and that was great. It's added to the, it complemented the comedy of it, that we've been, as viewers, we're like, oh my gosh, you know, these invisible, ferocious monsters, and they're not. So that was very well done. I like the breath as well. The breath was, even though they're invisible, the fact that they have the breath there really helped, I thought.
Because remember, in the book, I was like, as soon as something leaves our body, it becomes visible. Makes sense for breath, right?
Right. Yeah, that does make sense now that you mention it. But it was cinematically, it was a nice way to know where they were, but still have the have them be invisible, you know, not betray that. Okay, so all the Dufflepuds, I will say, was probably one of my favorite things in the movie. It was one of the very few things in the movie where I was really kind of going, oh my gosh, I feel like I'm seeing something from the book brought to life. Where I kind of went, wow, that's what, the Dufflepuds, they were in my imagination, and now they're real. I really got a buzz and a thrill from that.
Yeah,
and
pretty cool.
Yeah, visually pretty well done. They looked real enough for me. And they're just all these one-footed creatures. It's just hilarious for kind of all the reasons they're hilarious in the book. But like you were saying, really wish they could have done more with them. And then Koryakin scares off the Dufflepuds with the lint.
I remember you talking about this. I had already seen the movie, and you guys recorded a podcast without me afterwards. And I was listening to it, and I was listening.
And you were giggling, I'm sure.
And like, I was going, that's so funny.
Because we're like, what the heck? It looks like pixie dust or something. You know,
I remember that. And I was sitting here laughing and laughing.
The fairy dust is going to come later when Eustace is undragon, so we'll get there. But, and then I like how when Eustace is like, what are those things? And Koryakin goes, Dufflepuds. And Eustace is like, oh, silly me. I guess I should have known, you know, kind of sarcastically.
Yes, I'm like, yes, obviously they are.
Yeah, then it is established. Koryakin says that he made the Dufflepuds invisible in order to protect them from the evil. I suppose this means the mist. So it's just sort of them trying to connect everything. You know, you can't just trying to get rid of John Cheddar's episodic story and connect every single thing. What did you think about changing the reason? You know, in the book, they were made invisible. The Dufflepuds make themselves invisible, in fact, because they think they're so ugly. And what did you think about the fact that actually Koryakin makes them invisible in order to, I suppose, so the mist can't swallow them up or tempt them or whatever?
It was pretty random. I understand what they were going for, but it doesn't really make sense in the long run, because it's just, how does, it's another one of those unexplained things. Okay, well, being invisible makes you immune. Why does it do that? Why isn't everyone invisible?
Can't Koryakin just teach them the spell of invisibility, and now that's it? They'll be safe from the mist.
Right, and see, the only way it works is if you don't think about it too much. The minute you start thinking about it too much, it starts unraveling into million different pieces.
Yeah, that's the thing. It's just a shame because the book, I can think about the book and it holds up. In the movie, I have to kind of, oh, stop, don't think about that. Don't think about that. It doesn't make sense. I mean, like, like right when they get to the mist, they should just say the spell of invisibility. Go in there, get the sword. And they, two people in a rowboat can do it, you know? And yeah. So that was kind of a gaping plot hole. And then I think, do you think we can quickly bang out the Koryakin dialogue? There's not that much to talk about, really.
Except, let's see, Koryakin, the great trailer line machine.
Yes, that's exactly. Almost every line in the scene is in the trailer. But Koryakin goes there and shows them his map, and which is kind of neat. We see scenes from Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe in there.
I thought it was cool because when I saw that and I saw the centaur blowing the horn.
Yeah.
Which is Shane, by the way.
Uh huh.
And I was like, oh, look, it's Shane. I thought that was kind of cool.
And then Eustace, another example of him kind of warming up to the world, even though he doesn't want to. Where he's like, oh, that's beautiful. Then it's like, I mean, for a make-believe world. You know, he still has to keep that condescending Eustace tone.
It's quite in keeping with his character.
Yeah, it is. And this is where the whole plot of the rest of the movie is laid out. Where it's finally established, okay, you need the seven swords, and once you put them together, their full power will be unleashed. You know, whatever that means. Then the whole... Because apparently... Their filmmakers are worried we won't get the theme of the movie's temptation. So it's like, you know, don't fall into temptation. You must defeat the darkness inside yourselves. What other lines do they
just
have?
Anything that would fit in pretty much any trailer and work.
Almost any fantasy movie trailer ever.
Yeah, pretty much.
And so everything here is set up. And I thought this was one of the cheesiest scenes. That's another thing that even when we heard Koryakin's dialogue, it was... A report that came out of New York, some footage had been screened, and some people were talking about the whole scene of, you know, Koryakin's dialogue, and I think we all hoped they were just paraphrasing, that he wouldn't actually say, you must defeat the darkness inside yourselves. We hope that's probably not the exact line, they're just paraphrasing. It turned out it was almost word for word,
yeah.
That report. And it just, there's not that much to say about it. This is another one of those scenes, like The Lone Islands, that pretty much every Narnia lover can agree.
It pretty much stank.
Is like, yeah... That was really, really cheesy. And with that, the whole backbone of the movie's plot is set up.
Definitely.
And now we realize, oh, we must put the swords together. What exactly the swords are going to do, we don't know. We just suppose they're going to put them together and it'll blow up the mist, I guess.
All we know is that once you do it, everything will be fine. Don't worry about why or how. It'll just... Everything will be good.
Yeah, it's just something that it made it difficult for me to kind of get emotionally involved because I'm just kind of like, I don't feel like I have a good grasp on what's happening here and why it matters. So, in this scene in particular, I'm like, Koryakin talks kind of cryptically, you know? He's very vague. The darkness inside yourselves. Oh, there's another line. Well, until you lay down the seventh sword, evil has the upper hand. And the mist really is just... pure evil, and that's all it is. It's the most simple version of evil you could imagine. It's just this green thing that likes doing evil things because it's evil. And
no purpose, no reason.
No motivation.
No rhyme or rhythm. It's just there.
Why does it want to swallow people up, and what does it do to them? Apparently,
nothing.
At the end of the story, they're fine, so...
Yeah.
And apparently the Dawn Treader sailed right into the middle of the mist, and it couldn't swallow up the Dawn Treader, so... The whole green mist thing and where it came from, and I guess if they make the silver chair, it'll be explained, but...
See, it was supposed to be! It's just frustrating. It's just so frustrating, because what they had in the leaked script worked. I mean, it wasn't really Dawn Treader, but it worked. It made sense.
It was comprehensible.
Yeah.
Yeah, and this is
we
like...
We didn't like it, we loathed it, but it made sense. Here, it... really doesn't... We loathe it, and it doesn't make sense.
Yeah.
So, I mean, there's no redeeming quality to it.
Yeah. But, okay, so we managed to get through... I guess I kind of envision spending a lot more time on that Koryakin scene, but I guess there's not that much to talk about,
you
I guess.
You can't really... There's not much to discuss when everyone has the same opinions. Like, yeah, it stank.
Billy Brown's whole performance there, he just like, you must defeat the darkness inside you. So it almost seems like he's trying to scare them. Like, okay, this is too hard. We're leaving, but
Yeah. Let's go home now. This is stupid.
Yeah, that's probably the cheesiest, definitely the cheesiest dialogue scene in the movie.
Oh yeah, by far.
But we'll come to Deathwater later. We'll talk about that. But Okay, so at this point, on your first viewing, or well, I guess any viewing, whatever works. But on your first viewing, at this point in the movie, as we're wrapping up here, what how do you think you're feeling overall?
Oh goodness, when I watch movies, I watch movies. I don't think about how I'm feeling.
Right, but I know, but I'm saying that now, and that's very, very important. That by the way, I loved what you said in the previous podcast, where you said that you know you should not have any kind of running commentary or analysis going on during a movie. The point is you should feel it first. What we do here on the podcast is what we call retrospective analysis. Now we have to, okay, the movie made me feel this way, but why? Why did it make me feel that way? Is what we do here on the podcast. But are you able to recall about how you were feeling? Like, looking back, are you able to recall kind of how you were feeling overall?
Probably this would... I would be feeling not quite as bad as I felt when the green mist first showed up, but not as good as I felt in better parts of the film. So I'm kind of becoming to be quite... still becoming a little skeptical, like, okay, this could get good or this could get really, really bad. So
Yeah, I guess at this point, I thought, you know, the Reaper Cheap stuff, fighting Eustace was okay. Wish they'd kind of given it more depth, but it was okay. And then I hated Caspian's boneheaded decision he makes to sleep on the shore. And I thought the Magician's Book scene was okay. Didn't like having the mist in there and all that. Then there's that gaping plot hole of why don't they just become invisible to defeat the mist. And then Corey Aachen's dialogue, which I was really feeling like, I mean, you can just tell, oh, this is the Council of Elrond scene. This is where we set up the entire rest of the movie. Here's what has to be done and we're going to do it. I was kind of like, oh man, the whole movie is based on this. Oh, this really is a movie about trying to defeat the green smoke, isn't it? And so I guess I was kind of like, ugh, the rest of this movie is going to be this. So I was definitely not feeling good, but I guess since there were a couple things here I liked. Like the Duffelpuds, they were fantastic.
Yes. Duffelpuds, thumbs up.
I was kind of like, okay, there's definitely room for this could get better. You know, but definitely not liking it so far in general. Okay, there we go. So
I think we managed that all right.
Yeah, it wasn't bad. That was only like 40-something minutes, I think, once
I
edit this.
So we can do this. Who needs Rillian?
That's not true. Rillian has a much more composed... I was really trying very hard not to get too emotional in this, because I love getting loud and emotional and getting into it. And
you like getting into yelling fights.
Yeah, and Rillian's really good at, you know... getting across his passion without, you know, but having a very sort of a professional composed voice at the same time. But we did it. We managed to do it without Rillian. So I feel like we've grown a lot in this podcast. We can do it. We've proven we can do it. But maybe he'll be back pretty soon. All right. So further up and further in, our voyage through Voyage of the Dawn Treader.
Goodbye.